There's also Rod the last few days. I had it there a minute ago. Where is it? Yeah. Rod is, he was out for the last while and he was doing his thing at the Tramps nightclub and loads of the other stuff as well in terms of, there it is, look. Rod Stewart, 74, puts on a wild display as he parties alongside fellow Tramp patrons to mark the club's 50th anniversary with Michael Caine, 86, and Joan Collins, 86, also joining in the raucous nostalgia. Fantastic. He celebrated its 50th anniversary on Thursday evening, so the swinging 60s types all had to be there, and they were, I can tell you. But also, something else I want to say here that Rod did this week. I don't know if you saw it, a bunch of students, was it Leaving Cert type students in England, yeah, like that age group or whatever, kind of went into this place of model railway owned by people, and they wrecked the place just for no reason other than they wrecked the place. Drink fueled, as it said in the paper. And Rod, of course, major, all of that sort of stuff, absolutely devastated, so he donated 10 grand. So Rod Stewart says he's donating £10,000, that is, to a model railway club whose exhibition was destroyed by vandals. Market Deepening Model Railway Club lost years of work in the raid in Stamford in Lincolnshire on Saturday, and the 74-year-old singer and model railway enthusiast said he was absolutely devastated by the attack, so he's offering that kind of money. Which a fundraising page which was originally set up to raise 500 quid for the club has now raised more than 70,000 in just over a day. Four youths were arrested on suspicion of burglary and criminal damage have been released on police bail. So Rod in the news this week, and he was also in the news many times when I've interviewed him down through the years. We're going to take a look at a bit of all of that now. We'll just pop straight in and see what happens. The great Rod, he's one of the greats, actually, he really is hilarious. Anyway, let's start off with this and see where we take it.
If I had said to you in 1999 that the success you've had in the 90s, success you've had in the 80s, the huge success in the 70s, it's about to get bigger in the 90s, would you believe me?
No, it's been a tremendous like 5 years. I've made 5 albums in 4 years. So I'm very, very happy.
But not just made them, they've all more or less got
they've all done extremely well.
There's a bunch of number ones in there.
Yeah, and this was a real radical change. So we did the 4 American songbooks that were all standards, as you know, and to completely turn it around in a short space of time and have this album that got to number one. You know, it's like our American songbook, really. They're all songs that we grew up with, our age group. I hope you're the same age as me, Dave.
Absolutely. Now, the thing is here, the funny thing is, that's the US one, because that's what it is. That's the kind of subtitle of the album. So is it pretty obvious the next one might be still the same, the UK one?
What, songs that have come out of the UK? Well, it could be, but I don't think we'll be doing another still the same album. If I get my way, which I tend to do, I want to do a country album. Or a blue-eyed soul album, you know, great.
Okay, country album, blue-eyed soul album, and whatever it might be from Sam Cooke that you were interested in 100 years ago album. What about Rod Stewart writing songs album?
Well, I don't think, you know, the way things are going now, and I look at the likes of Paul McCartney and Neil Young and the Rolling Stones and Sir Elton John, they've all brought albums out last year which got great critical acclaim, but failed in the charts. They just didn't sell, especially Elton's last album, you know, that really went down the toilet. And it was a self-penned, all were self-penned albums. So I'm a little weary. I don't think people want to listen to our age group, what we've got to say anymore. You know, I know Bob Dylan's album got to number one, but it contained a lot of covers that he'd changed old blues songs.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's a good point. But see, you've always been singing.
That's my point, and I'm sticking to it.
And it's very good, too, really good. You're an interpretative singer and have been all the time. Every time when the biggest albums were happening for you, there was always the mix of the two.
Yeah.
Like, there was maybe a Tim Harden here and a Maggie May there and all that kind of thing. But, I mean, like, now it's interpretation to the point where do you feel vindicated in some way, saying, look, I'm so good at this, I can do anything. I'm like kind of any diva from the past, if you like. I have the great voice. So what I'm saying, I suppose, is the songs that you sing, is it really Rod Stewart they like? Is that what really the
yeah, without a doubt.
It really is, isn't it?
I think the choice.
So like Paul Simon couldn't do those songs and Paul McCartney couldn't. And
no, absolutely. I'm glad you hit the nail on the head. I've been waiting for someone to say that. No, I've got God's given me a wonderful instrument. The voice I'm talking about, and I just really think I can sing anything. You know, I've proved it with the American standards. I'm not, maybe I'm blowing my own trumpet, but I mean, I'd love to do a country album because I, you know, you're in my heart, you're in my soul is a country song. So Yeah, I'm lucky. It's God's gift, though. Although I've worked at it, it's still God's
gift. OK, God gave you this great voice. He nearly took it away in the year 2000, didn't he?
Yes, he did, the little bugger.
Absolutely. That didn't... Like, that was, like, serious. Could that have killed you? Or could it have just made you lose your voice for life?
If I hadn't have gone for the scan, it probably would have done me within 18 months. But because I'm so health conscious, I was always having... I'll try and go for a scan every year, full body scan, and they found it. So I was in and out of hospital, you know, in 24 hours. So I was, you know, I can't actually say that I've battled cancer and I've survived. You know, I was really lucky. I was in and out, whipped it out, and so.
But I mean, the muscles in the vocal cords, everything had to be moved and everything had to be changed. So was it like literally starting off again when that happened?
Yeah, it was, and you're right there, because everything has to be moved aside, and you know, and you suffer memory loss. The muscles forget how to sing.
Yeah.
So, you know, the voice didn't come back for 6 months. And then I had to, like, retrain it to sing again.
And was it a quiet time in your life then, Rod? Did you have to keep your mouth shut?
I could talk a little bit and then the voice would disappear. You know, they didn't warn me about this before the operation. I still would have had the operation, but yeah. I would have been really scared. But, they, you know, they rip you open all the way through there, and for a singer, it's frightening.
It absolutely is, because, I mean, like, when you have to do it all again, to just sit at a piano and go do-re-mi with a singer.
Exactly.
With a piano player,
exactly.
Now, I can just imagine your patience. How long did that last?
It lasted, as I said, 6 months, and I decided... This is not working. What I need to do is
get the band
back in. Is what I did. I got the band into the house and we just tuned, plugged in and started playing the songs. And then I could sing, you know, one song, then one and a half songs, then two songs, then three songs. And after a couple of months, I was doing 2 hours.
And that was it?
That was it. That was I was back. Yeah.
Right, okay. But I mean, it was a very scary time, and you would, I presume, at the end of all this, try and advise everybody, for God's sake, is everything at all, just go on.
Go for a scan. I mean... It could have got to such a point that I wouldn't have even known I'd had it, and they just say, sorry, mate, you've got 6 months to live. You know, it's thyroid cancer. It's and the doctor said, if you're going to have a cancer, he said, this is the one to have, you know, because it's the most easily treatable.
So, you know, you did a single once in 1970 that became one of the biggest ever hits of the 1970s by 72, which is Python Lee Jackson thing.
Mm.
Did you get paid in seat covers for that? That's true.
Yeah, no, carpets.
Carpets
for my... I had a car called a Marcos, which was the Jack LaLanne car at the time, yeah. And the guy said, a mate of mine, he said, come down and sing this song. The singer can't sing, and show him how it's done. So I went in there, two vocals. And, you know, after Maggie May, they suddenly realised what they'd had and they released it. But it is a good song. I'm thinking of bringing that one into the live show.
But when you say the Jack the Lad bit, I mean, previously, like, with the Long John Baldry going through, it could have been Fleetwood Mac here, or it could have been Cream here, or it could have been anyone. Mm-hmm. And you were kind of all shuffling around the same bunch of people. Mm-hmm. Blues was the thing. You were way into your Sam Cooks and all this.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people were getting into, say, crooning in 62 and then Beatles after that. You were into all that kind of stuff. But right through it all, like, there was a documentary once on TV in 1965, and Rod the Mod was featured.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like everything seemed to fall into place very well for you. Everybody loved Rod Stewart before even the Faces hit big or anything. Mm-hmm. Did you ever think of it that way, saying, yeah, they really did, and God, they really blew it out of me then in the 80s when I did my Britt Ekland bit?
Yeah, I went, it's the old cliche, I went to Hollywood, you know, and went out with a famous film star, and, you know, apparently that's the worst thing you could possibly do if you're supposed to be a dyed-in-the-wool rock and roll singer. But I do feel... a great love from the public that come and see the shows, you know, and I do try and give them 110% every night, you know, I really do.
And no matter what show you do or whatever you do, do you have to have what would be considered to be great musicians, mostly a rock band on stage with you?
Yeah, it's very important, you know, because I have such a varied collection of music to go through, although on the next tour I don't think I'll be doing the standards, that I've got to have musicians that can play everything, and these guys I've got now can play everything. I change them every now and then, so I need some new blood in.
This business of, like, you had a single out, whatever, it was a Tim Harden song or something.
And Reason
to Believe. And the B-side was Maggie May.
Yeah.
Now, obviously you hadn't a clue about hits then. That's what I'm trying to say. You don't know anything, do you?
No,
DJs picked up on it.
Well, those were the days when you made albums and you didn't care about singles. And if there was was a single on it, they'd say, well, I think we've got a single here, and release it. But yeah, true, the A-side was Reason to Believe, and they said, oh, put that pile of shit on the B-side, Maggie May, and it was this jockey in Cleveland that turned it over.
Right, yeah. But the thing is also, that I don't know if it's still in the record books, but 1971, September or whatever it is, number one of the singles charts and album charts in Britain, number one of the singles and album charts in America as well. And this is the time, by the way, when singles really meant something.
Yeah.
Now, is that a good moment to look back on?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because it was actually 1971, and it's 35 years to the day, 4 weeks ago, when this album went number one in the States. So it's fairly amazing.
It's not well, I mean,
35 years.
I can only think of none of Dylan's albums went number one at the beginning anyway, but the Modern Times did is pretty
strange. Modern Times did, yeah.
How does that make, did you look at that and say, how does this get to number one?
Well, now I've listened to it, I can understand, because it's my boss is a guy called, I haven't got a boss, he's the head of the record company, Clive Davis. He said it's try and make concept albums. I think the Dylan album, what I've listened to, is more of a concept, because he's taken some old blues songs and changed them around a bit.
Yeah. Are you lazy, Rod? Because I mean, like, songwriting wise, you know, some of the stuff has been, some of your most famous stuff, all your most famous stuff really before 2000 is your own stuff, really.
Yeah.
And yet, half the albums was other people's songs as well. And it was all your stuff that was really bigger and more famous and great songs, great stories as well. You're really into telling stories. Tonight's the Night, Killing of Georgie, all this kind of Maggie May, a real coming of age story. But I mean, like, you know, you don't really write very much, do you?
No, I don't. It's, and you're right, I am, and I openly admit I'm a lazy bugger. I was when I started out, when we started writing songs with the Faces, you know, they had to lock me and Ronnie Wood in a room to get a song finished, literally lock us away, we'll let you out in 5 hours, give us a bottle of wine, and we'll let you out in 5 hours when you come out with a song, you know. And it's always been like being at school to me. I didn't like being at school, and it's the writing songs. Although when they're finished, and you hear them on the radio for the first time, it's like your children, you know, you're very proud of them.
Okay, but like when you say with the Faces, let's face it, every single thing you did with the Faces, everything that was created with the Faces was created in a pub.
Yeah, I can't remember too much about the Faces days.
Right, but I mean, it was almost cool. Like, you were, the Faces, you were shambolic, because that's who you were.
Yeah.
Your hair was shambolic. You had to look shambolic. You had to walk across the stage and trip over that Celtic scarf. All that. Yeah. It was all part of it, wasn't it? Well, but it's the exact opposite now.
Well, you know, obviously I'm 61 now, so I don't go about doing what I did when I was a lot younger. But the reason we were so shambolic, the word you use, is because we were, 9 times out of 10, we were all pissed. Really, we really get pissed as fast. And the reason for that is that we didn't think we were very good. You know, we just didn't think we were very good. You had 2-3 Small Faces guys, right? And 2 guys out of the Jeff Beck group. You know, it just didn't, to us, we said, what on earth are we all doing together? And then it clicked. Due to the amounts of alcohol.
But no, see, the thing I'm trying to get at here is in the 1980s, when you kind of lost a lot of it, and the Brit Acton thing, and let's face it, the boater on the cover of that magazine, on that album. And
yeah, it's horrible.
What was it? A Night to Remember?
Night to Remember, that's the Titanic. Night on the Town.
Night on the Titanic. Anyway, on that album cover, like, I mean, that was pretty low in some ways, you know, in terms of style and a few other things as well. But people didn't really give out about you because of who you had been in previous decades. People always took you as Rod's always having a laugh. You were all over in Hollywood, living the dream with the fast cars and the blonde women. You were having a laugh.
Well, I'm still doing that a little bit. It was a terrible album cover. You know, I was very much in love with Brit, and I mean, that album cover had so much makeup on. I don't know, I look like the Avon girl, you know. But you know, I was listening to everything she said, and she dressed me up, and that's where I was wearing her knickers at the same time, and that went down in rock and roll folklore. There was a dodgy period, but you're right, the public sort of stood by me, bless them.
Could you have been a professional footballer, really? I know you've probably been asked that before, but could have you signed up with Brentford?
No, I was there on trials, you know, and they were interested in me. I can't say I signed up. It's something the press have ran with for so long. But to tell you the truth, I was never good enough. You know, I didn't have the commitment. I did it to keep my dad happy.
Right.
He had 3 sons, and he always wanted one of us to be a footballer. But it was the same time as I started loving music, and the avenues were opening up in the music business.
You brought your own kids back to London once and brought them to the house we were brought up in, where you had a very, very happy childhood, and it was brilliant. Yeah. But, I mean, the house probably looks like, a, you know, that size now.
Yeah.
How did they react to it?
Well, it probably isn't as wide as this screen. It was a council house in North London. So I took them there, and they were just shocked. And the people who were living there at the time said, "Oh, Rod Stewart used to live here, come in." And we walked in, and even I was shocked how small it was. But my little kids, it was Liam and Renee, the two little ones, they were absolutely shocked. I said, "Dad, this whole house isn't as big as my bedroom." You know. But I try and do that with the kids, and I've taken them all back to where I grew up.
Well, but you've also part of your land over in Hollywood. You've let them have a house over there. Looking back on that, was that a good decision?
The worst decision I ever made. You know, it's 7,000 square feet. I mean, that's huge. It's got sunken baths, walk-in wardrobes, and marble floors, and mouldings, and the three of them are going to live there. That's Sean, he's 26, Kimberly's 27, and Ruby's 19. And it's literally, I would say, 20 yards from my house. Right. And the thing is, I don't think I'm ever going to get rid of them, you know, because it's so luxurious and they're so lucky. And I thought, my God, what have I done? I'm never going to get rid of them. They're going to be living there when they're 35, 40.
Last time I spoke to you, you mentioned Ruby starting possibly a music career.
Yeah.
Is that gone? Is that happened?
Yeah, yeah. She's, I spoke to her yesterday. She's been rehearsing with her band and, you know, she's listens to some of my advice, but not a great deal of it. She's very strong-minded. She wants to do it her way. She doesn't want to, you know, use Rod Stewart's name. And I said, we haven't got much option with that unless you change your name. Mm. But she's got a voice. She's got a voice, but she's a little narrow-minded when it comes to how she wants to do it.
And by the way, does your sister still write to you in the States saying, have you changed your underwear and all this kind of stuff?
Yeah, bless her, my sister Mary, yeah. She still writes me letters every couple of weeks, handwritten, lovely letters. People don't do that anymore, do they? It's all faxes and texts.
And emails and all the rest, yeah. OK, football, we've got to talk about that for the moment because...
Up hoops!
You still have a football pitch at your home in Britain and you still have a football pitch at your home in America.
No, I haven't got one in America. No. The one is in this country, in England. It's in Epping. It's full size, the size of Park. Head,
but you don't play anymore.
No, the knees are playing me up, but I still run the team. And I mean, I've had Celtic have trained on it, Liverpool, Newcastle, a lot of Premiership teams have played on it, trained on it.
You've seven kids.
Yeah.
Ever think of the mastectomy?
I don't know where that one come from. No, I'm not gonna do that.
By the way, can I just say this? I'm on the subject of five different mothers, right? Okay, of the kids, right? Okay. I mean, like you're partial to blondes all down through the years, as people know. See if we got the names mixed up.
The wives? Yeah. I'm sorry, the mothers? No, never. Never.
Really?
And I don't see the mother of the firstborn if she was adopted because, you know, I was 17 or 18.
She did get married recently, or not so long ago.
She did,
she sent a bunch of flowers.
Sent some flowers and some money, but she doesn't keep in contact with me. She writes me letters and never gives me an address to write to.
Right.
But with the other mums, I'm on great terms, the other four. Well, of course, one of them I'm getting married to. Get me all confused now.
By the way, like the love of your life in the 90s, from the year 90 to the year 99, then it broke up in 99. Well, the problem was that she was too young when you married, wasn't it, would you think?
Yeah, yeah, without
doubt. You were 45, she was 20.
She was 20 when I met her and 21 when I married her, and I should have, as my wonderful sister told me, she said, you should know better. You know, I should have, you know, given her at least 4 or 5 years before we got married.
Right. But you don't regret it. Like, look at the... Even in the musical career, like, the Faces were doing whatever it was, and everything was happening that was probably quite good. You kept going on to other things. Now, I know the solo career was taken over from the Faces, but you never seemed to... It just... You fell into place with a few drinks, and people like that.
Yeah, I've always been nonchalant about my career. That's not to say that I don't take it seriously, but what I'm trying to say, I think, is... If something goes wrong, then it doesn't faze me. And if I have huge success, I don't go overboard either. You know, it's I take success and failure at the same level of acceptance.
And when you look back on the way you were on the road, there were great times, were they? I mean, like, there was one time you were in America and you actually appeared as Fleetwood Mac. You played as Fleetwood Mac because you were kicked out of some hotel.
No, the story, we checked into a hotel because the Faces... were banned from all hotels or Holiday Inns across America because we'd been smashing them up. And the only reason we smashed them up is because we weren't getting any respect as customers. So we checked in as Fleetwood Mac because we weren't very well known in those days.
Mm.
And then we smashed up another hotel. We did all sorts of things. Ronnie Lane, Mac, Ian McLagan, burrowed through from one room into Ronnie Lane's room with a fork because only breeze blocks. He made a big hole, you know, we all went into the next room. It was hilarious.
Those kind of things don't happen too much on tour these days.
No.
By the way, like, you used to go on stage plastered all the time. Was there ever one time you said, right, I'm going to try it sober tonight? And that's what happened, kind of, or did it just gradually happen?
No. I mean, you'd be a weakling in the faces if you didn't have a drink before you go on. It was part of the ritual. But nowadays, I probably have one rum and coke, and I've got it in my mind that that's good for my voice. It's Dutch courage, really, but... No, I don't get plastered anymore. It's a whole different ball game, you know. In the Faces days, we used to play for 3/4 hour, and it was finished and down the pub. But now it's, you know, you've got to do at least 2 hours, you know, and it's a lot, it's a bigger effort than it used to be.
Sir Mick, Sir Paul, Sir Elton, what's wrong? What happened?
Oh, well, I'm sure I'll be looking at the New Year's honours list this year.
I'm sure you have in the last few years. God.
Well, I haven't heard any rumours, so, but you know, it's. I'd love it, but it's not the be all and end all.
You were on with something on TV last week. You mentioned something about acting. That you actually could possibly have got involved in that football movie, which you've only got into it for the Escape to Victory, Sylvester Stallone. Yeah. Is that really true with Sir Michael Caine?
Yeah, I'd love to. I was actually asked to do that movie, but I've got no interest in acting. I mean, I love getting up and singing, and that's all I really want to do.
And what about the last thing you mentioned something about model railways? If, for instance, Model Railway magazine came along and said they want to put you on the cover of Rolling Stone, which would you take?
Can't say that. Well, I'm actually going to be on the cover of Railroader magazine, it's called, in this time next year. So that will be a dream come true for me. But I was just in Rolling Stone, but I wasn't on the cover. I think they've got pissed off with me.
Yeah, well, okay. And did they give you a good review, by the way?
Yeah, they did.
When you did one of the biggest tours you've ever done in your life, which is around 1979, direction, you did South America on this massive tour. Do you remember that and how crazy it was, and maybe it was too much and too expensive and too mad, and, like, you know, the Faces was a good laugh there. Did it cure you of wanting to go completely silly with, like, silly airplanes and all that?
No, what, you tour of Brazil?
Yeah, it was all over South America.
Yeah, I don't know.
You can't remember.
I played Brazil, you know, and had the
record
attendance. That was
3.5 million people in one game.
It was more than that. It was in the Guinness Book of Records. It's 4.5 million, according to the Guinness Book of Records. That was just a one-off. It was a New Year's show, and no one paid to get in, by the way.
Right.
So it was on Copacabana Beach. But
would you ever do the Las Vegas thing?
Yeah, I'm doing it in a couple of years.
No, what I mean is, like, do the 6 months, like...
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, yeah. Vegas is not what it used to be in the days of Elvis and Frank Sinatra. You know, it's no longer, you know, supper clubs and people are eating while you're singing. It's beautiful venues. You're paying attention, Dave.
Yeah, sorry, I'm looking at the time.
It's beautiful venues.
I've never been to Las Vegas.
Haven't you?
No.
Oh, it's gorgeous now. I mean, it really is. I mean, you play beautiful venues. It's 5,000 seaters. Everyone's got a great seat, wonderful stages. So I'm looking forward to it because, you know, I'll be able to go home every night after every show, back to LA, see my kids.
By the way, when I mentioned that thing earlier on, finally, just about songwriting, when I say stories, do people get that from Rod Stewart, do you think, enough? Do they know Tonight's the Night and Maggie May of Coming of Age, as they call it, and The Killing of Georgie? You're into that kind of thing when you do write, aren't you, stories?
Yeah, I've always considered myself a storyteller, and, I believe there'll come a time when I'll release an album of songs when I feel I've got somebody to write with and I feel I've got the time to do it. You know, that's it, because I'm a very slow writer. It's terribly slow. I can't just knock out 5 songs in a day. But when I do get the time, you know, I don't know when that will be. I'm sure there'll be another album of self-penned songs, and that will be fulfilling for me. And if it doesn't sell, it doesn't sell. And if it doesn't, I'll kill myself.
Good enough, Rod. Thank you very much indeed, Rod, for talking to us. Thanks very much indeed. On 2FM.